Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Ram Trucks, the ones with the guts to stand apart, join a league all their own. Guts, glory, Ram. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 300 for August 28, 2015. 6 years, 300 shows, and one of the most beautiful cars in history. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, Gary Vasilash, great to see you.
John, how are you doing?
Here we go. Big, wow. Big drum roll. Listen to this. Episode 300.
Unbelievable.
300 of these shows.
Committing social media 300 times in a row.
I've never heard anyone express it that way before, committing social media. I rather like that term. So we should let everybody know, too, we've got Michelle Krebs with us tonight from Auto Trader. Michelle, great having
you.
Glad
to be here. I don't know. Where's the champagne for 300? It seems like champagne was in order.
Yeah. We would have brought it'll just be the bubbly conversation.
That helps.
That works.
You mentioned this is show 300.
What number was that again?
Yeah. And we've got to let everybody know that we've got Carl Brower with us tonight from KBB. Carl, great having you here.
Glad to be here.
Even better, you brought your car with you today.
Yeah, you know, if someone would have told me even a few months ago that I'd be sitting in your studio with my car, I probably wouldn't have believed them. But between the owner's rally that's happening right now in Motown and my desire to be here for that event and have my car here for that event.
Okay.
And we should point out, you're from California, so this is...
Exactly. I had to come out from, Bloomingdale or something.
Carl, did we tell you this is an episode? I was trying to cover for you, Ben.
Show 300.
That wasn't my car, by the way. Yeah.
Okay,
I'm
and now, we've been talking about your car, but there are podcast people who are not seeing what the cameras are showing. So tell everybody what we've got on the floor of the studio right now.
Sure. We've got a 2005 Ford GT. On Sunday, 4 days ago, it was the 10th anniversary of me taking ownership of the car. So it passed its 10th birthday, at least from my standpoint. I'm sure it was built a few weeks before that. But it was its 10th anniversary of my picking it up with 7 miles on the odometer from Santa Monica Ford in August 23rd, 2005. So it's 10 years old.
And you drove it all the way here just to bring it to our studio. No, tell us why you're here.
Close. I shipped it from L.A. to Detroit because I wanted it here for the owner's rally. This is the 9th owner's rally. They didn't have one the very first year the car was on sale. It's the second time they've had it in Detroit, the first rally, which I also went to 9 years ago.
So this is all GT owners?
All GT owners. There's about 110 of us here, 120 somewhere in there.
And what was the total number of cars they sold?
4,038.
Okay.
But, you know, a good chunk of those went to either Canada or Europe. Some went even to Australia. And unfortunately, a certain amount have been crashed, although I think most of them people have brought back. There's a frightening number of salvage title Ford GTs driving around. So
this car was $150,000 when it first came out,
give or
right?
Take, yeah.
But they've gone up, right? What are they worth today?
Yeah, I mean, you really can't buy one for under 200 grand, even if it's got like a salvage title, as long as it's in nice shape. You can buy one that needs a bunch of work, but if it's a complete running car in great shape with a salvage title, and it's one of the more common colors like red, it starts around 200.
But I hear you can pay easily $350 for them now, too.
If you've got a desirable color, you got low mileage, you start going toward 3+, and then if you have one of the Heritage Golf livery ones with low mileage, you can get over $400.
Did you expect that when you bought it?
No. I was very focused on not thinking of this car as an investment. I've seen so many people over the last 20-plus years of my life in this industry thinking they're going to buy some exotic car and it'll be an investment, and they never are. So I told myself before I bought it, is it okay if this car drops to 50 or less thousand over the time you own it? And I quickly answered yes, because I want the car because it's an awesome car, not because it's an investment. So I love the fact that I specifically told myself, don't think of this as an investment when I bought it, and I had the one car that's become an investment.
How many driving miles do you have on it?
27.5. 27,500 miles I've put on it. I went to Denver once from L.A. for my 20-year high school reunion, and I was commuting from Camarillo to Santa Monica several years in it. That was 50 miles each way, so that added some
commuting.
Miles.
Don't you hold your breath when you're on the 405? Like, don't get near me?
That was PCH.
Oh,
I was
okay.
I was coming from Camarillo out to PCH, so 40 of those 50 miles were on Pacific Coast Highway.
You know, for a car like this, that's actually quite a few miles.
Yeah, exactly. No, there's believe it or not, though, there's a guy out there, 125,000.
Man.
I was just going to ask you, what's the mix of the owners? What are the owners that have come here to Dearborn? What?
You know, first, there's people from everywhere. I think I saw three Minnesota license plates right next to each other in the parking lot yesterday. We had them all gathered at Ford World headquarters, and so it was a pretty amazing sight. But there are people here from California, like me, Florida, Massachusetts, Arizona. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know if every state's represented. Probably not all 50, but there's people from everywhere. And there's a lot of...
I'm sure Canada, too.
Yeah, and I think there's some Canada people here, too. There are, actually. Yeah, that's right. And Texas, I know there's two people from, like, West Texas.
We talk about different countries, Canada and Texas.
Yeah, two different countries. It's like a whole other country, you know, Texas. But... And the profile is interesting. You know, you have a certain amount of people who you would expect to have expensive cars, and they're wealthy individuals. But you have a lot of people who, you know, it was kind of a financial stretch once in a lifetime. You know, this isn't their 18th, and they're looking now for their 19th exotic car. There's a lot of people who are not in that circumstance that don't afford GT.
So you think it's their exotic car and their daily driver is some old beater that...
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who this is like their big deal special car. They probably never even planned on buying a car like this, but because of how unique it is as a mid-engine V8 car all built in America, the one of one, really, they went ahead and stretched and got it, and then they still have like down-to-earth normal cars as their other cars.
So is this built in Wixom?
Wixom and Saline Special Vehicles. It was a two-part process. Most of it was done
thanks to the UAW.
Yeah. Yeah.
Know that story, because the UAW said, no way in hell, non-union labor is going to do the assembly of this. So most of it was done by Saline in Troy,
right,
then shipped to Wixom, so the final assembly could be done at the Wixom plant by UAW workers.
Yeah, and all that was done there really were the seats, the engine, and then all the like final certifications.
Well, the engine was a Romeo.
Yeah, the engine came from Romeo.
Romeo,
plant.
Michigan, yeah, and... So now it's now the Wixom plant is an RV park. I mean, it's
yeah.
I think Cabela's is putting a store. Yeah, they're going to put a lot of places there. That plant was ginormous.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to say
they're empty for quite
a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I want to say under roof alone, it was 3 million square feet. I mean, it was gigantic.
I've got pictures of there has to be 200 to 300. Ford GTs lined up in that plant that were done being assembled and waiting to be put on trucks. And I remember thinking at the time, you're never probably ever going to see this many GTs next to each other again. So I took a whole lot of photos because I was fortunate. I got to go out and see mine on the assembly line.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I got to ask, what do you think of the new one?
I think the new one is wild on so many levels. And I actually have some breaking news to talk about the new one, too, that I just
tell
heard
us.
That no one else has heard. But we all know that the new one's going to be rather pricey. And it's going to
$400,000,
and that they're only going to make like $200,000 to $250,000 a year, something like that. So you think about the price, and you think about the allocation numbers. I mean, there are still hundreds of GTs that have never left dealer principal hands because the dealers wanted them from the 4,038 of my generation that were made. So when you start thinking about those kind of numbers and costs, you wonder how many private individuals would really be able to get a hold of one. And that's what I was thinking once I heard all those numbers months ago. Ford is going to let private individuals apply for ownership of the vehicle, then Ford will be the one approving it based on Ford's metrics and all of who will approve Ford ownership in the history of Ford ownership, and specifically GT ownership of this generation will be things that elevate your chances. And once you're approved, then you will pick from a list of certified Ford GT delivery dealers that will deliver the car to you. The dealer will technically not really have control of the car.
And the thinking behind this is what?
They really want to make sure private individuals get the car. They want to make sure that the customer, this car is about Ford's customers, and they want to make sure customers get a hold of the cars, not people who can spend the most money to get on dealer lists or dealer principals.
So how is this not basically Ford selling you the car rather than Santa Monica
Ford? Still going to the dealership.
It's still processed at the end of the day by a dealer. and the dealers will apply to be certified as dealers for the car.
I think it's fascinating that Ford's taking that approach. I got to commend them for it, too, because, as you point out, so many of your generation GTs have never gone outside. They're not driven around. They're just...
Which is really frustrating for me, John. When I drove it to Denver and back for my high school reunion, I was coming back, and a light rain started to fall in the middle of Utah, and I remember specifically reaching for the wiper button going, gee, I don't think I've used these before. I hope they work. Of course, they came on, and the car just kept going. And it occurred to me, like, I had an epiphany at that moment. And I thought, you know, there are so many of these things sitting under bubble wrap in some person's, I'll use person versus the other word that goes through my head, person's collection, starts with rich, rhymes with Behold, sitting in some person's collection in a showroom with 8 miles on it. And all those guys at Ford went through all the trouble, all those engineers, I know a lot of them, to make the car a real car. I've got 27,000 real miles on my car. It is a real car. It's almost insulting and kind of a mean thing and a disrespectful thing to all those engineers to not treat it like a real car, to treat it as some kind of underglass thing, an investment thing. Hmm. And so I'm thrilled that I got it. I'm thrilled that I have experienced it and driven it because it is a real car and I've treated it like one. And I'm thrilled to think that the new GT, in spite of its limited production numbers and its increased cost, will very likely be driven by another set of people who already own this car like a real car again. It'll actually be out there being seen. It won't be sitting in some, you know, OCD guy's garage with his other 18 Ferraris.
So speaking of real cars and real people, you should probably know that Camillo Pardo actually sat in that seat
on this very show.
Really?
Yeah.
It's the spirit of Camillo.
So there's a big party at Camillo's tonight, too.
There's a big party at Camillo's tonight. Yep.
You can tell him you sat there.
I hear he has parties at that loft, is what I hear.
Oh, I've been to a few of them.
Yes.
They're wild crazy.
And we had
wild crazy.
And we had he's right there.
Oh, there he is.
See, he was walking.
That's his newest thing. See that orange nose on it? That's his new paint scheme.
Yeah, he commissions cars. This was yesterday, by the way, out in front of the world headquarters. We had like 120 of them lined up out there.
That's fantastic.
But he gets people will commission him to create cars, and he'll have total control. There's mine, the one on the left there. He was the one who originally did the design, obviously, so he knows what other optional ways to paint the car to make it look pretty wild. And so people will come and say, Camillo, come up with a design for my car. Mm-hmm. And that's what those custom paint jobs you just saw were.
Yeah.
And we had Craig Metros, who worked on the new one, sitting in that chair, too. So,
yeah.
Man, you're in GT heaven.
I'm in a place
yeah.
right now.
Ah. So you love the wildness aspect of the new GT.
Right.
Visually, your GT versus the upcoming GT?
You know, I'm probably a little biased, but I look at this car and I'm, to me, if you were going to list the top 10 best looking cars in the history of the automobile, this one's somewhere in that group. It might be in the top 4 or 5. I think 275 GTB might be my personal favorite of all Ferrari 275 GTB, but that's a fabulous looking car. It's just a fabulous looking car. The new car is very expressive. It's got all sorts of crazy things going on with flying buttresses, and it certainly has some GT DNA in it. So I think it's very cool, and I think it's going to do really well in terms of its racing, which is what it's really supposed to do. Remember, that's a racing car first and foremost that's going to be on the street, and mine was not designed to be like that. And so there's some compromise, like when you look inside, it looks like there's about a nickel's worth of space between you and your passenger because the way the seats are aligned, because they have to have the back end close in so quickly for aerodynamics. But, I mean, I think it's going to have its own, it's going to be its own thing, and that's really what Ford needed. They could not do a third revival of that same 1960s car, and they knew that. And then it was better for them not to, because this car, as good as it looks, it's not good at going 200 plus at Le Mans. They needed a car that was good for that now.
Michelle, are you a fan of this car?
Oh, yeah. And I remember I drove it out at a little racetrack out on the western side of the state.
Gingerbread Raceway.
Yeah. I remember driving it there, and Camilla was there, and just a total blast.
That was the first time I drove it, and I'll never forget that. Because
Me neither.
I was very fortunate. I got to moderate a panel last night of all the original GT team members in front of all the owners at the rally. And all those guys I pretty much know anyways from the past 15 years, 10 years, watching them build this car. But Tom Rickenbacker is one of the main guys that was on there. He's at Honda now, actually, on their running their race team. But he was there the moment that I realized the car was going to be fabulous. You know, like, I wanted the car as soon as I saw it and I knew it was going to be built. specifically and purely because it was this great homage to a great moment in American racing history. And truthfully, I didn't really care too much about how good or bad it was. I wanted it to be good.
Right.
But if I would have come out and been mediocre, I would have still been happily bought it and owned it because of what it represented. And I'll be honest, and I told this to all the guys last night, all the Ford people and all the owners that were there. I mean, in 2003, 2004, you're hearing that Ford's going to try to outdo the Ferrari 360. Tell anyone in this room want to tell me they weren't a little skeptical of that goal that Ford had? And when I drove it on Gingerman that first time, it took like three turns. And I can specifically remember in my head, my brain going, oh, man, it's going to be good, too. It's not just beautiful, and it's not just this very unique moment in time and its design, and it's going to pay homage and all this. It's actually going to be a full-fledged, fully capable supercar that's going to compete and, if not, be better than, you know, contemporary supercars at the mid-2000s when it came out. And that, I was just thrilled. I couldn't believe it. It's like, this thing's going to actually be really good.
Yeah. It is a beautiful car, and I agree with you. I think it's more beautiful than the upcoming car. I think the upcoming car is more interesting technically.
Right.
It's going to easily be able to outperform this one. But visually, I hadn't thought of that before. It may be in the top 10 most beautiful cars of all time. I hadn't thought of it that way, but I could put it on that list.
Yeah, I'm biased, but I just think it's incredibly well designed. And you know how when a car is good design, well, it got a great design. There's not been a bad, I can't imagine one of these things that I've ever seen, or I've never seen one, that doesn't look fabulous, even with some of the crazy colors and things I've seen people do to them. When you have certain cars, you almost have to paint them certain colors before they'll look good. This car, I agonized for a year. I knew I was getting the car in May of 04, and I didn't have to order it until June of 04, and I didn't have to order it until May of 05, and I still didn't know what to tell when Ford finally called and said, okay, we need your car specs, and I was like, I don't know what color, and everyone at Ford was telling me blue, and it looks fabulous in blue, and I'm thrilled I got blue, but it looks fabulous in yellow, it looks fabulous in tungsten, it looks fabulous in white. I almost went white, and when you have a car that looks good in every color, that's because the basic design is flawless.
One other thing that's so special about this car is, as you said, it's an homage to the original GT40. It looks better than the original.
Yeah.
And that never happens.
That's the amazing thing. I mean, Camillo deserves a lot of credit, and everyone who really has studied the car, really, you can't be a Ford GT fan without being a Camillo fan, because you realize that he somehow made it better than the original.
So when you were talking to the other owners last night, I mean, what was their sense of the new one?
Yeah.
Did they talk about it much, or was it basically looking back at your...
It's a great question, Gary, because I had a guy who told me specifically he was not interested in getting the new one. He had no real interest in it. But there are plenty of current Ford GT owners arguing over who's going to get one first.
Clearly they're not dealers.
And this was the funny thing. There's guys out there saying, my dealers told me I'm number one on the list. And of course, no dealer right now knows who's getting one. And until today, did they even know how it was going to work? Now they know. If I get one, it's because I'm going to be processing it for a buyer who's already been approved to get it from Ford. So all those people who are putting down deposits and claiming they were going to definitely get one, and all the dealers who were going along with that. So
you showed us, we showed the video of all the owners out in front of the Ford headquarters.
Yeah.
How much is Ford supporting this whole meet of everyone getting together?
They're being fabulous. No, they're being fabulous. They had us over at the Performance Design Center today when we heard the announcement about the allocation system. Then they went out on the track and did some parade laps with them. And they're letting them, I believe, I don't know if they're driving or riding in.
And this is some of the top executives at Ford, too?
Raj has been there.
Raj Nair, the head of engineering.
Raj Nair, Jamal's going to be there tomorrow night.
Meaty, head of all Ford Performance.
Yeah, Jamal Meaty's going to be there. And tomorrow night we're doing another, and I think I get to moderate another panel, and Jamal's going to be on it about the new car, because the last one was about the old car. Yeah. So Ford has been fabulous. I think Ford recognizes that this is a pretty, not only is this a unique car, this is a unique owner body. I mean, you have a lot of people who I think were longtime Ford people, but I think you have a lot who weren't particularly Ford people until this car came out, and they have completely been sucked in to the Ford ownership passion and dedication. And that's why they're doing this allocation with the new one. They realize, and it is, I mean, there are car clubs out there all over the place, of course, and car forums online. But you talk to anyone who's got a Ford GT about the Ford GT forum and the Ford GT ownership experience, the Ford GT rallies, this being the 10th one, and it is almost like this surreal magical thing. Everyone is, the people are fabulous, the atmosphere at these events is fabulous, the sense of camaraderie, the support, the help. When you go on the forum, any question you'd have, the 4GTForum.com, they've got answers for you there. Someone will help you out if you've got a problem. Some other forums, you know, I won't mention any names. It kind of sounds like Ferrari, but some of the other forums out there, it's not quite as supportive. I'll just say it's not quite as all-around, you know, supportive. There's a little more, you know.
It's congenial.
Yeah, a little more pecking order, a little more elitist, maybe. Just maybe a little.
So Carl, put your automotive analyst hat on for a minute. I mean, so for those that don't know you, you're just not a 4GT owner. You're also one of the leading analysts in the industry.
Dude, I'm nothing but a 4GT owner now. It's all been flushed away.
It's all secondary.
It's all been flushed away. I'm nothing but a 4GT owner.
So going to the new one, we may have to wait until after the break. But
we got 30 seconds.
Okay,
here.
So time to think about this. So does the new 4GT make business sense for Ford as a corporation?
Okay, you want me to answer now in 20 seconds?
Yeah.
Sure.
18
these
seconds.
These cars never make sense if you look at a spreadsheet. This car didn't make sense if you looked at a spreadsheet. And if anyone wants to deny or claim that this car didn't benefit Ford Motor Company, I'll tell them they're crazy to their face.
Okay, now you do have to pause because we're going to take a break and thank our good friends at Bridgestone. Okay, we're back. And you were, just to finish that thought,
This
car did make business sense for the Ford Motor Company.
Well, it paid for itself. They didn't lose money on this car. Mm-hmm. But I think trying to come up with a way, what this car's value was in some kind of a calculation is impossible. This car was on the cover of multiple magazines for years. We had it in the long-term fleet at the last website I worked at and all. It got promotions through there. Right now, there's a big group of these people owning these cars, over 100 people, and they're driving around Detroit and Dearborn. And all these people who don't know anything about GTs 10 years after they were made are asking a bunch of questions. Who built that? Oh, gosh, it's a Ford and all. You cannot put a dollar amount on how much this car promoted Ford's brand and capabilities to build an amazing machine. And by the way, I love the story behind the car. To me, the only thing cooler than the car is that the time frame they were given to build it in and the obstacles they had to overcome and that they did it. So there's a whole nother moonshot to the fact that the car ever even got made.
Well, Chris Theodore was running everything then, and he gets the credit for doing that, really.
He was at the event last night, and he had great stories, as you can imagine, to tell. But, this is an incredible vehicle, and everything about it, from the way it was made to what it looks like and the thrill that it delivers 10 years later and the support and passion that it creates for Ford Motor Company among this owner group, for Ford not to do another one, you could argue wouldn't have made sense. It's them doing another one. It's almost like, well, you had to do another one. What happened last time you did one? You got to do that again. You can't just never try that again.
And remember what was going on at Ford at that time. My gosh, we didn't know if they would be in business. It was things were looking.
When the yellow one rolled up,
products.
When the concept car rolled onto the stage at Cobo Hall in 2002, January, I distinctly remember having almost simultaneous thoughts. Oh, my God, that's the coolest thing in the world. Man, does it suck that Ford can't do that. Because it was inconceivable to me, given Ford's challenges they were suffering at the time, that they would actually ever produce a car like that. Mm-hmm. And they did. And it was when I finally learned about, when I got to know and talk to on several occasions the team behind the creation, and then, of course, when I drove the final product. I mean, it was actually quite inspiring for me. I mean,
oh, look, here's a great picture. Here's the team. Dan Gurney.
Yep.
John Coletti, I think that
John
is.
John Coletti, yes.
Yep. Chris Theodore. Mm-hmm. Nick Shayla. Carol Shelby and Jackie Stewart.
Yeah, and that was at the Centennial Celebration. That was why it was such a challenge, because Bill Ford Jr. said, when he signed off on the car, you can make it. And it was like March of 2002. We need it by June of 2003 for the celebration. And don't forget, they'd shown the car at a show, and everyone fell in love with it because of how great it looked because of Camilla's work. And then they had to engineer the car around, inside of that look. And as Fred Goodenow, who ran the assembly part of the car, told me, he said, most cars First of all, they're not 5% production ready when they're shown. Even concept cars are usually much further along that. This was 5%. 5% of the car that was at the show was actually capable at that moment in time. And they're not shown to such specificity on the exterior that you can't change them. Most cars, you design the chassis, you design the platform, and you have a sense of what the body will look like, but you make all the tweaks necessary to make it fit under there. They had to fit everything under the body after they'd shown it because everyone loved the body. So a compressed time frame inside a body that had already been shown on a 5% feasible production car.
Yeah.
In 18 months.
No, it's really impressive.
It was a total moonshot. And of course, I have to plug too, this car specifically was detailed by a place called Esoteric Detail down in Columbus. And I had heard about this shop from a guy who worked at Acura. He had an old NSX he had done. And he told me, these guys are work miracles. And I'm like, well, I'm in California. It doesn't do me much good. And then I shipped the car back here for this event. This was like last year, I heard. And I shipped the car back. And I just, like 2 weeks ago, after everything was all in place and thinking I'd fly out on Monday of this week, I'm like, wait, how far is Detroit from Columbus? I don't know this area better. You guys would all know that answer. 3 hours. I called him. Hey, you know, Todd Cooperrider at Esoteric Detail. If I bring my car down right before the rally, it's going to be a Sunday and a Monday. Can you guys do it? And he's like, yeah, we'll work on it for Sunday and Monday. So that's why it looks as 10 years old, and it looks better than it did the day I rolled it out of the showroom, because they removed all the little scratches and stuff that are in cars. Hmm. Yeah, there it is at Esoteric Detail.
Good. Hey, we've got a comment coming in from, not a question, a comment from After Hours guest 552. He says the 2005-2006 model never outperformed the equivalent Ferrari. And he says that's because they benchmarked the 360. And by the time that they introduced the GT, it was the 430 that was out and blew it away.
He's wrong.
Really?
First of all, it blew away the 360, like it wasn't even close. And then the 430 came out, which wasn't really what it was benchmarked against. And I still distinctly remember the Motor Trend article where they ran the thing against it, and all the spec numbers showed this car beating it. It was much tighter than the 360. It still performed better in that article. And then I remember Motor Trend still gave the Ferrari the win. And I remember thinking to myself, well, you know, this is how it works with the enthusiast books. What's the new hot car that we want to make sure the manufacturer likes us for and all? It's like, so this car that costs less and performs better, but you're going to say, you know, and they did the, I don't want to say the standard Motor Trend thing. They did the standard enthusiast publication thing. You know, in spite of the fact that this car, you know,
costs more and is slower.
Costs more and isn't as fast. That refinement and loveliness of the Ferrari, we really have to give it to them. And I was a little biased, too, as I read the article.
The only weakness in this car, and I think this is where the 18-month development shows up, is the interior. And it's not that it's a bad interior.
Right.
But it's like you can see where they just said, boom, that's it. Don't change a thing.
Right.
Let's keep charging along in the program.
Well, you can actually see that the drivetrain too. Remember, it's got an aluminum 5.4 dry sump engine, so it's a very advanced engine. But it's basically the same engine that was in the F-150 Lightning, because they were talking about all sorts of. They were talking a V10. They were talking one of the Coyote engines, which ended up getting delayed a long time, as we know, because of various challenges they had financially. But John Colletti made the call. He said, "Look, we do not have time to screw around." I think he probably used another word than screw, knowing John. But he said, we don't have time to mess around with this. We have a compressed time frame.
Is it rhyme with luck or something?
Yeah, duck. So he said, we know this works. There's a known quantity out there. It's called the 5.4 liter F-150 Lightning engine with a supercharger on it. We're going to not just slap it in there. We're going to upgrade it substantially for the GT. It's going to be an aluminum block and not cast. It's going to be dry sump instead of wet. And that's what we're going with, because we know we can do it very quick and easy to get it ready.
Hey, we've got a couple of other questions that have come in here. Not apropos to the Ford GT, but I think we ought to get to them in this segment.
Sure.
So I'll throw it out to all of you, though, here. Jay Cujo wants to know, with all the press that Ford and FCA are getting by having real names, will Cadillac ever get the hint that they need real names again? Michelle, you want to jump on?
I would think that they wouldn't. You know, especially with the new leadership, I don't think that that's probably in the cards.
And they've already announced CT6,
right?
So it sounds like they have a whole
and
new...
And they just started the renaming
system.
So you're
suggesting Johan is not a
I'm
word
guessing
guy?
That. I'm guessing that, you know, he thinks it should be alphanumeric for international reasons.
What do you think, Gary?
He could change his name to JDN1 or something.
If he really believes in the alphanumeric system, he would do that.
He should do that, yeah.
So I guess we're...
Well, okay, I mean, it begs a question. Are the Europeans going to change their nomenclature?
Is BMW? No, but
they've always had it. Right. Not like they abandoned it or changed to it. You know, that's how it's always been. Although they are jumbling them all around.
Plus, if you look at the vehicles that, you know, this was a topic we were talking about earlier. This has kind of been a nostalgia week. We've got, you know, Dodge saying it's bringing back the Barracuda.
Oh, we'll get to that in the next episode.
Okay, all right. Yeah. Well, you know, there's all these old names coming back, but they're very, a lot of those vehicles are mostly for the American market. So that's a big difference, I think.
I think they're going to stick with the alphanumerics.
What about Lincoln? Do you think Lincoln will stick with it, having shown the new Continental and calling it that?
I think it'll be called a Continental. I don't know if in 10 years we'll be talking about Lincoln.
Well, that puts a whole different thing on it.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like you look at Lincoln, and they're a great example of how not to do alphanumeric, you know, MK something. Mm-hmm. And I've said this before.
We can't even keep track of the public.
I see Lincoln people. You know, I've seen Lincoln representatives in press events. No, wait, I mean MKT, not MKC. But the human brain is fairly simple the way it classifies things. And the first letter is like a big part of it. And then the second letter really starts to cement things and all. The reason 3, 5, 7 works and the reason S and E and A class, you know, E class and all work, because it's very clear right from the beginning those cars are different. And even CTS and ATS was okay because the first letter was different. But when you start getting into MK something, now we're going to have CT something. And I think that's a mistake.
Yeah. Well, as you can tell from the music, it's time for another break, and we're going to get into some of those other things that you brought up there, Barracuda, Bronco, and a number of other
things. Grand Wagoneer.
But, first we've got to give a shout-out to our good friends at Hyundai coming right up.
We could tell you about the years of research and development, how we forged advanced high-strength steel to make the frame stronger yet lighter, the countless hours spent testing the suspension and tuning every sound from the engine to the trunk. But until you get behind the wheel, you have no idea. The completely redesigned Hyundai Sonata.
And we're back talking all kinds of good car stuff here. But, Michelle, you brought it up. So what do you think this week?
It's been nostalgia week because there have been reports that the dealers for Fiat Chrysler were out in Las Vegas seeing future product. And I think what's interesting is there's been so many rumors about Chrysler pushing back. I can't say Fiat Chrysler. I'm still not used to that.
Yeah.
But that they've been pushing back a lot of product launches. But they told the dealers there, you know, up to 30 new and refreshed products, a Dodge Barracuda convertible, a Jeep Grand Wagoneer for another name from the past. So I think that's kind of interesting.
What do you make of the Barracuda, especially, you know, because we all know it was the Plymouth Barracuda.
Well, yeah, and it's really interesting that it's such a great name. You know, and I think it's great that they're bringing it back.
And you're the analyst here, especially too, in addition to Carl. But you know, they've got the Charger, they've got the Challenger, now the Barracuda. Is it too much?
I don't think so, but I do wonder if this. You know, what we've seen in the market, sales are down compared to sport utility sales, except for performance cars.
Right.
And I really, things like Camaro and Mustang and Charger, Challenger are doing great. But is this a bubble? You know, appeals to a certain age group.
They're doing
great
as a percentage of sales, not in terms of raw numbers, though.
Well,
they're not shrinking. They're not contracting.
Growing.
So I mean, they're still selling more Fusions than they're selling Mustangs.
Fusions are down.
Struggling to sell, and the Chargers and Challengers and the Camaros aren't struggling.
But I better margins.
Right. See, but I look at it. Does FCA US LLC, see? The brain does.
You like alphanumeric, obviously.
Obviously. Yeah. I'm going to go to work for Cadillac. does that company need another niche seller, or do they need something that is not a Jeep and is not a Ram that sells in volume?
Oh, my head.
Yes, they do.
My head just exploded. A Chrysler that's not a Jeep, not a Ram, and sells in, wait a second.
Or even a Dodge, you know, like
I guess that would be possible, wouldn't it?
Well, and Dodge is, but they have set the Dodge brand up to be more of the
Right.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying, as a corporation, I mean, don't they really need to have something that catches fire and sells in volume?
Big time. And that's what the Dart was supposed to do. And in fact, the Challenger is selling as well as the Dart.
Yeah. Right. And
at a much higher price with bigger margin.
You ask anyone, certainly if you ask me, the two challenges for the Challenger company are small, fuel efficient cars and, of course, presence in China. No automaker that doesn't have both of those things going forward, growing and looking promising, is going to have a very good position in another 10 years. And everyone knows that. I think that's why we had Sergio running around looking for a dance partner so much in the last few months. So I love the idea that Barracuda comes back. I love that they make 700 horsepower Challengers and Chargers right now. Chrysler is doing a lot of stuff that I personally am thrilled with. But as an analyst, I still say, okay, what's the long game
here?
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. They're doing a lot with what they've got. And I think they've been brilliant at doing that since they came out of bankruptcy.
Exactly.
It's, you know, lipstick on a pig kind of thing. But working with what they've got. But they, you know, not real well set up for the future in terms of...
Well, I keep saying the Dart really should be a hot hatchback. That's what the Dodge brand needs.
You're right.
And they bring back the Caliber?
Oh, never.
Oh, God.
Well, you know, as long as they do it right. Yeah, don't bring back the name or the styling, but, you know, something along those lines that really works well.
Something that sells, okay.
Yeah, that's what they need.
Well, then across town, another revival of old names. We're hearing that the Wayne Assembly Plant, the Michigan Assembly Plant in Wayne, is going to build a Ford Ranger and the Ford Bronco. Those are kind of blasts from the past.
The C-Max and the Focus are... getting out of that plant because
and
they're clearly, just not selling well.
The margins. They've got to do it in a place that costs less to produce, and they need something with higher margins in those plants. I know Ford was looking across town at GM and how well they're doing with the Chevy Colorado and the GMC Canyon and thinking, ooh, wish we had the Ranger
there. They're the world's biggest truck maker. They're not going to have a midsize truck in a market where the midsize truck seems to be doing as well or better than anyone
hoped. Seems to be. And again, I wonder if that's a bubble.
What do you guys think? Are they going to bring in the International Ranger, or are they going to have to come up with something smaller and cheaper?
Well, I think they're going to have to do something. I mean, if you look at what GM did, they could not just bring in the International truck. It just was not going to work in this market.
But the Ford Ranger is a pretty slick truck. I haven't driven
it. I haven't driven it either.
And guess what? This International Ranger that we've got up on the screen right now is actually slightly smaller than the Colorado.
Well, and I think there needs to
be
a little
helpful.
And I think the other thing that, when I heard it was just being discussed, the Ranger, I think what's really going to make it work is bringing in the Bronco, because I think there is room in this market for Ford to do a sport utility like that. If you look at a lot of what they have that's, you know, the Escape, they're kind of soft. And you look at the success of Jeep with the Cherokee and Grand Cherokee, there's a little more rugged, and I think the Bronco can fit that niche for Ford.
Oh, I totally agree, especially if it's anything like the original Bronco. We got a picture of that up right now, because even though everybody's talking about, oh, yeah, the OJ Bronco connection,
I know the name.
I know the original Bronco because Parnelli Jones drove Bill Strope-prepared Broncos in the Baja 1000, and that's where I know the thing from. And when you look at it, you could take the doors off. Could you put the windshield down? I think you could. But in any case, that's as Jeep-like as anything.
Okay, but it didn't end up that way.
Correct.
I mean, the OJ Bronco was not what was not this Wrangler variant that we were just looking at there with the doors off and what have you.
But think of the marketing too that they're going to be able to do with these really strong iconic names. I think it's a
and if
really
they want to
move.
Go alphanumeric like Cadillac, they could do an OJ version.
You know, what's sort of ironic is that the factory that they will be putting these into used to be called the Michigan Truck Plant. And then they changed it to Wayne Assembly Plant.
No, there are two separate plants there.
So the other one's empty now?
The other one's empty.
Okay.
And that makes all the sense, because that plant is set up for body on frame, which is what this Bronco and Ranger are going to be. I don't know what the hell they're going to do with Wayne Assembly, but they're two separate facilities.
Mm. Well, I think the other thing they need is a smaller sport utility, you know, under the Ford Escape. So they've got to be thinking that.
The EcoSport.
Well, the EcoSport, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the EcoSport hasn't gone over all that well in Europe.
No.
And Europe is more like the American market than, say, Brazil or other emerging markets where that EcoSport has done very well.
Yeah.
But I still think, I think it's crazy that Toyota and Ford, two manufacturers who've made a lot of money and a lot of gains on their SUV lineup, don't have any HRV CX-3 competitor.
Yeah, a B-class crossover.
Exactly.
I mean,
not even an
indication they're going to make one. I mean, in my mind, you know, maybe they could be real creative and we don't know anything and the car is going to be shown and go on sale 2 weeks later. But usually it doesn't work that way. So if we saw something in Frankfurt or in L.A. or Detroit, we're a year out from having those things available. Mm-hmm. I just can't believe they're ceding market share to these other players.
And they've
for
got
so
the mechanical base to do it.
Yeah,
you know,
they've got the global platforms.
And I thought when all this, before they announced anything about Ranger or Bronco, and actually they haven't announced that. All leaked out, right, through the UAW. But I thought for sure it was the Echo Sport. To your point exactly, Carl, mm-hmm. this is the biggest gap in Ford's lineup. Exactly. I thought the Echo Sport was a natural to go into.
Well, it's got to be the next void to fill. They've got to fill that spot.
You don't think they'd put the Bronco name on a sub-escape-sized SUV?
I don't know. They got to go after Jeep. That's what this Bronco's got to be about.
Right.
Go after whether it's Wrangler or Renegade, I don't care what. But then again, on top of that, they need the Echo Sport in this market like yesterday.
Yeah.
Yep.
In fact, there's an Echo Sport up there right now on the screen.
Well, here's a thought. This just occurred to me.
Isn't that a scene next year?
As I sit here and with all these brilliant minds around me, it just occurred to me, what's a quasi-SUV they've got that I think is fabulous but hasn't done that well?
The Flex.
So maybe the Flex at some point disappears and the Bronco comes
in. Well, look, the reason that they've kept the Flex because the volume's never been great. I think they do about 3,500 a month or something like that. But in California, Flex does terrific. And it brings in people who would never come into a Ford store.
Mm-hmm.
Farley told me that years ago.
Yep.
Because it was like, why are you guys sticking with this program? I mean, you're just not selling
Talk
that
to people
many.
Who own them. They love them.
It's their least successful SUV. It's also my favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I was going to buy any of their SUVs right now.
Well, it's a minivan alternative.
Right.
All right. So through June, okay, so this would be a half-year numbers for Flex, 10,595 units. That's
10,500 a month.
So sales have dropped way off from where
sales, so that's just the first half of the year. Sales are off 14.8% for the year compared to
even those loyalists in California might not be able to keep
it alive. Well, I'll tell you another reason. Go shop them. There's no discounts. There's no screaming deals.
They aren't
cheap. Lexus.
And remember, they're made in Canada, which is a little more expensive to make vehicles there than other places.
Isn't that where the GTs can be built?
Yes.
Yeah. By
Multimatic.
By Multimatic, the same one.
Just outside of Toronto.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing. That's a good thing.
What were they doing that we were talking about earlier? Multimatic did the...
Well, Multimatic is... I never heard of them.
Right?
They built the Ford racing engine, the 3.5-liter EcoSport. I love that EcoSport, but EcoTech.
Yeah.
You know, or no, I got that wrong. EcoTech and EcoSport.
Right.
You know, if it's outside this country, it's Echo. If it's inside this country, it's Eco.
Oh, is that right? Okay.
I'm getting off track here. Let's turn to Dr. Data, because I know he's always got some interesting numbers for us.
Yeah, after I had those Ford numbers, now I'm losing the other numbers. So this was a bad week for racing where a driver was killed, Justin Wilson, and got hit in the head. But let's look at some positive aspects of racing here. So I thought it was most bizarre. This never occurred to me. I mean, part of the thing is that the manufacturers get involved in racing because it's good for their brands, right? And that they get some elevation of the brand. And so I got this news release from IndyCar this week, and I was astonished to read this. It said, Honda received a deduction of 20 manufacturer championship points for an engine that did not attain its life cycle during the ABC Supply 500 race weekend. According to rule 10.6.4.3, 20 manufacturer points are deducted for an engine that fails to reach its 2,500 mile life cycle mark. And I thought, wow, there's this rule and they have these deductions. And so I looked into it and say, what's the deal with this stuff? So basically, you get four fresh engines at the beginning of the year, and you have a total allotment of 10,000 miles. And then 20 points will be deducted for an engine failing to complete its life cycle and an engine undergoing a non-minor repair that requires a component change. An entrant-initiated engine changeout will result in the loss of 10 driver and entrance points. The manufacturer is not charged. Okay, so where are we at right now?
Blazing over.
So basically what this means is that they've got this really bizarre way that they do this. Okay, so I looked at F1. Okay, so Formula One also, you know, again, now these guys are spending zillions of dollars, right? So right now, there have been 11 races in the Formula One season. There's 8 to go. Right now, Mercedes is leading the constructor points with
a wide margin.
426. Ferrari is second at 242. Then Williams is at 161. Red Bull at 108. Lotus, 50. That's the top five. Okay, it goes down to 10. The way they do it is they basically say, okay, we're going to take Lewis Hamilton and Nico Rosberg's points and add them together, and that's what the
that's what Mercedes gets,
and then we're going to add the others, and that's how it works out. And there's not this really bizarre thing. So then, if you look at the IndyCar points, the way they stand right now, there's only one race to go, so Chevrolet will undoubtedly take the Constructors' Championship this year. So Chevy has 1,429, and Honda has 1,083 points. So if you look at the top five drivers in IndyCar, there's only one Honda, which is Graham Rahal. And you've been a big fan of Graham Rahal.
My boy.
And so Montoya is leading the championship, and so they have these really bizarre points. So I just think it's interesting that you have these racing series that manufacturers become affiliated with in order to get their names elevated. Now, the interesting thing was that I thought, Chevy engine and Honda engine. And, you know, you think Honda because Honda is so well known for its engines. You know, some people argue that basically Honda's an engine company that just happens to wrap cars and lawnmowers and whatnot around those engines. And so, you know, I contacted the companies today and I said, so where are your engines built? And The Honda engines are built in California at Honda Racing Development.
HPD.
And the Chevy engines are built by Ilmor Engineering in Michigan.
In Plymouth. In fact, until 2013, Ilmor built both Chevy and the Honda engines in Plymouth. And Honda didn't want anybody to know this.
Wow.
In fact, the way they split it was all the races east of the Mississippi were sourced out of Plymouth, Michigan. Everything west of the Mississippi was sourced out of HPD in California.
Hmm.
And they kept that pretty damn secret.
Wow, that's very secret.
So anyway, we're going to take another quick break here because we got to give a good shout out to our friends at Ram for sponsoring this show. And we got plenty more to talk about. In fact, we got to get into closed cockpits or not. Speaking of Formula One and IndyCar, that's also a big topic. And I'm sure there's plenty of other things, too. So we'll be back shortly. Okay, we're back, and just to segue off what you were bringing up there, Gary, about F1 and Indy, we've been talking on Autoline Daily a lot this week about should these open cockpit cars have an enclosed cockpit or some other way to protect drivers so that we don't have another situation like Justin Wilson getting hit in the head by debris from an unrelated accident and unfortunately losing his life. So what do you think?
I think they absolutely should have cockpits. I mean,
closed cockpits.
Yes. I mean, you think about it. They're basically going faster than airplanes go when they take off, right?
So you're going those velocities.
Yeah, they were averaging 220 miles an hour at Pocono.
Wow. So think about that. So, I mean, the ground effects are keeping them down, but I mean, the drivers are exposed. So let's just imagine your next flight that, you know, you're just sitting there and you're wearing a helmet and saying, good luck to you. Mm-hmm. See you later.
They're low-flying machines for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would almost compare this situation with like the Hans situation. You know, mm-hmm. It seemed very weird and maybe restrictive to not be able to move your head more freely because you had this big, you know, Hans thing on your head. So a lot of people were kind of waffling on using it, even though it had already existed for years. And then the Dale Earnhardt situation finally changed everyone's mind.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And maybe this one will change people's mind about, okay, this is another kind of paradigm shift we're going to see in vehicle safety design. We're not going to mess around anymore.
I mean, let's face it. I mean, the aesthetic of the cars that, you know, started out at Indianapolis compared to the aesthetic of the cars that exist today. I mean, back then, you know, the driver is upright and you could see the guy and
no seatbelt. You know, he's just right in front of him.
Yeah, he's just driving along. And you know, and now, I mean, the driver is so low inside that. I mean, the helmet almost looks like a canopy, right?
Really much difference to just put the last piece of protective material
exactly.
right over his head.
Exactly.
Yeah. One of our viewers made a really good comment, I thought, and he said, hey, look at the unlimited hydroplanes. They used mm-hmm. to be open cockpit,
yep.
and now they've got a bubble canopy just like a fighter jet's got.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And he says, and they haven't had any issues with, like, ventilation or, in the case of an accident, getting the driver out of this, even these things flipping over upside down in water. So I think he made a really good point.
So where do you come down on this?
No, I would rather still have them open cockpit. I would like to see a taller windshield so that the driver's helmet is below the top of the windshield mm-hmm. and have it, you know, this plexiglass fighter jet cockpit kind of a thing. So you still have the open cockpit. I still like that. But now any debris that comes flying, it's going to get knocked over the driver's head, not go full face into their helmet. So
maybe we'll get to the point where, you know, it's like the shields around the Starship Enterprise and stuff like that, where
there's
a force field we can't see. So it looks like he's still open cockpit, yeah. but anything getting near there gets bounced away.
I think there's going to be a lot of studies. I think some clever solutions will come out of this.
It'll be those autonomous race cars that you talked about a few months ago. And
we don't care if they get hit in the head. The robots.
That's right.
The robot cars.
Okay, we got two analysts here. I'm dying to ask you both. We've seen massive stock market correction mm-hmm. the world over. We've seen China all of a sudden like slam on the brakes. We've got August car sales for the U.S. market coming up next week. Mm-hmm. I've seen reports from both views that the stock market route and everything is going to cause car sales to go down for August. I've seen others go, this market's running strong. So, Michelle, let's start with you.
Well, Kelley Blue Book does our forecast, and we're saying 4% down, but not for those reasons. I mean, it's a weird month because Labor Day last year kind of straddled the 2 months. This year it's fully in September, so we don't get any of the benefit of that in August. Yep. One fewer selling day. You know, and we knew all along that this, you know, we were up at the 17.5 SAR rate. We knew that wasn't going to last, and we knew that this month would come that we were off from a year ago. I think it'll be the first time in 19 months or something like that.
Yeah.
So, but we're not panicked. We still think it's still coming in at a SAR of 17.2
million. But is that because of the day that's absent? I mean, so
that and the, well, because
the
because you don't have the promotions by the dealers. I mean, any holiday is a huge
So what you're saying, too, then September should be awesome.
Yeah, because
should rock.
Because,
yeah.
If we're,
so what do you see, Carl, for August sales?
I mean, I think we're going to be, you know, it's funny because we've made a lot of predictions in the last 6 months, and the market has continued to slightly surprise us.
Yes.
Which means if the market slightly surprises us to the good, by the way, this month it'll be flat. We're saying 4% down, which means if we took the average that we and a lot of other people have been off over the last year or so, we might be flat with last year. But I think the important thing is that the stock market issue seemed pretty, you know, transitory. It didn't seem like a real basis in, you know,
at least today.
Well, in this country. Now, are there problems in China, or is China being creative? We'll just use that word in how they've been reporting their economics over the last few years. Yes. And are we starting to see through the creativeness? Yes. But all the fundamentals, everyone agrees, are still...
In the U.S.
In the U.S. are still what they've been for years. They're still moving in the right direction. And, you know, for better or for worse, you know, we know a lot of people are financing a lot. They increasingly come up with creative ways to buy the cars, leasing, long loans. And I think a lot of people are driving old cars. We know they keep getting older. The average fleet age now is 11 and a half years. So it's
going
still
up.
Going up in spite of the increased sales over the last 2 years. So... those people, I think they're the least likely to be impacted by the stock market. When you think about it, a lot of the volume sales are by people who are financing cars.
Subprime.
These are not stockbrokers or even have stockbrokers or even know what a stockbroker, you know, a lot of them probably don't care what a stockbroker is. So they're not going to be at all impacted or minimally impacted by the brief stock market hiccup that we saw that already seems to be.
And wouldn't it be lagging? I mean, so, okay, the stock market is went down, then it went back up somewhat, but I mean, let's say it stayed down. I mean, would we see that
in this month?
Right.
Exactly. Well, what you would see if it went down and stayed down, maybe some luxury, some premium. You know, the cars that the people who really care about the stock market would maybe suffer something.
It's interesting. Mm-hmm. If you chart luxury car sales and specific luxury car makers, and there's only like two exceptions to this, and the stock market. They are hand
track.
In hand.
Yep.
Track exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
So as the stock market goes up, the sales goes up, and when the stock market goes down, they go down.
Oh, interesting. So we should really pay attention to luxury car sales.
Now, the exceptions, it's kind of interesting, the exceptions, Cadillac, Lincoln, and Volvo. And I would argue those have had their own independent problems of change in direction.
So let's see,
they
Cadillac, Lincoln,
perfectly.
And Volvo. Volvo's coming back up, and Cadillac and Lincoln have been down.
Would some people argue that of the luxury brands, those are
luxury? Yes.
Or,
you know,
or just maybe premium? Or
Yeah.
Well, here's another question then related to all this. I am blown away, at least in the Detroit market, I don't know what it's like countrywide, of the incredibly cheap lease prices that are being advertised. And people say, oh, John, you're so naive. That's just the switch and bait kind of a thing. But last Sunday in the local papers here, you could get a Malibu for $74 a month, $1,999 down. I think it was a 2-year lease. Mm-hmm. But there's other stuff that is, and just to finish that thought, we had an intern working with us this summer. You know, he wanted to get a new car to go back to college. He's got a great dad. His dad's going to buy him the car or, you know, lease the car for him. Looked at a Fusion. Couldn't afford it. Why? Because the insurance was too high. So he went and looked at a Buick Regal. Could save $1,000 a year in insurance instead of getting a Focus, getting a Regal. What did he go home with? A 4-door Chevrolet Silverado pickup, very nicely, you know, loaded, not fully loaded. Why? Because it was the lowest monthly payment and the cheapest insurance for
Interesting.
Him.
Interesting.
So what is going on here? Are you guys running into this? I mean, and if I name the brands, it's Chevrolet, Nissan, and anything from FCA have just got these incredibly low leases.
Oh, absolutely.
And again, you know, are you a returning buyer? Do you got a lease? You know, are you the company buy? Are you... Nonetheless, even if you take all that stuff away, it's so easy to go out and get a brand new car these days for about $150, $160 a month.
You know, it's going to be really interesting, though. So, well, leasing's, you know, almost a third of the market.
It's over a third, it's over 30% of new car purchases are
leased. These are giveaways.
Yeah.
I mean, these are giveaways. So you guys would know this. In 1956, Lee Iacocca, then an assistant zone manager in the Philadelphia region, came up with the idea slogan, 56 and 56. For $56 a month, you could have a 56 Ford. Well, now, in 2015... Well,
that's when 56 was real money.
Real money. Well, I ran the numbers, and in today's dollars, that's more like $350 a month.
Okay.
And that's $74 a month you can get a Malibu for in 1956 dollars. It's $8.66. So that's why I'm saying, what the hell is going on here?
Well,
have these guys lost their pricing discipline, or are the dealers doing what? I can't figure it out.
Well, leasing is used, and here's the other thing that's going to get real interesting. These lease cars come back. And that's why we've been somewhat, you know, there are other very optimistic forecasts for new car sales out there. I think Merrill Lynch is at like, oh, we're going to peak in 2018 at, you know, 18 million. And we just don't see that because there's this huge flood of used cars coming back that'll, you're going to go to the new car dealership and say, gee, that's a way better bargain. And in fact, there was a study today, an Experian of used car, the span between widening gap between the used car payment and the new is
highest. But I mean, I thought I read that actually used car payments are going up because the cars that are coming back tend to be more well equipped than, you know, if, you know, back in the day.
They are going up, but they're not going up as fast as the new cars. So the gap is still getting wider. And you're right, Michelle, because what's going on in too is an increased awareness of used cars in general and CPO in specific. I mean, the real hot ticket these days is certified pre-owned, because people are starting to realize I can get a cheaper vehicle or a less expensive vehicle and have new car peace of mind in terms of warranty coverage. And just like there's 7 and 8 year loans going on now, and there's leasing going on, this is another way. I mean, people are, you know, both people and dealers and manufacturers are all coming up with the most creative ways to get people into a car that they can still afford.
And looking at the monthly payment, because that's what people look at instead of the overall price of the
car. All it's based on is monthly payment.
So what happens to the industry by, let's say, 2018? I mean, is it going to go down?
We are saying it's going to be like at this level 17 kind of thing. But, you know, if we get a dip in the economy.
Or if interest rates move around.
Yeah,
but I don't think they're going to.
Now it looks like they won't. Right. So, you know, good news, bad news on the whole stock market shuffle there. But, yeah, I think there is still, when you have 11-plus-year-old cars out there, I have been saying this for years, there's still what I equate to almost a dam waiting to burst in terms of demand. That's the reason we get these spikes, and we've had this we get these monthly spikes, and we've had this certain general increase in car sales. It's because basically anyone who can possibly justify getting themselves a new car, and 7 and 8 year loans help do that, leases do that, they're doing it because they've got old cars and the cars, they're just tired of the cars and the cars are wearing out. And if anything could just start to really cement some confidence, if the middle class could really start to move
pay
up.
Raises.
Exactly.
Yeah, well, this country desperately needs pay raises.
Exactly.
You know, the middle class has been flatlining for 2 decades.
Yes. Yeah, and that's what we're, so all this is happening in that atmosphere, John. That's exactly it. And I just keep saying, you know, whether it's a change of administration or whatever like that, if we can just get, and we don't even need, you know, Happy Days or Here Again songs, but just something to move us off of this malaise that most of the country still feels like they're in, a lot of them do, car sales are going to explode.
Except the car prices are going to keep going up, especially with regulations and the add content to the vehicle.
But the big thing is, you know, disposable income and what percent of it can you devote to the new car? And I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I looked this up. And if you look at the percentage of Americans, percentage of the population that are buying new cars, the peak was 1978 and the year 2000, two best years in the history of the auto industry, when 6.8 and 6.9% of the population bought a new car. If the same percentage bought a new car today, sales would be 22 million.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It wouldn't be 17. Even if you just go back to the year 2000, sales would be 20 million today. So what we've done is we've shoved a good part of the middle class out of the new car market.
But there's another thing, too, is we have there are other options. If you live in a city, you Uber, you Zipcar. And I think the real big question is going to be, you know, we're starting to see millennials get into the market. What's going to happen when they're forming their households? Will they buy the second car? Because that's when, you know, people bought two cars, three cars for the household.
That's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
It is. It's a whole nother show.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, we've got, you know, at some point, not too far away, eventually, autonomous vehicles.
Yes, exactly.
And that's going to change the entire game. Yeah. So.
Look, we got a lot more we could talk about, but I think it's a good time to wrap this up. So, Carl Brower, thanks so much for coming here, especially for bringing your car. It always makes the show better.
You don't want me to bring mine here?
Hey, we're talking about used cars. There's like, you know, you could bring a used
car. Yeah, for the next show, I'll bring them.
Right.
Okay. Michelle, great having you here, too.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And Gary, we'll figure out how to do show 301.
What was today's show?
Yeah.
I'm thinking. Oh, yeah. It's a wrap.
Wow.
100 episodes.
I want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Ram Trucks, the ones with the guts to stand apart, join a league all their own. Guts, glory, Ram. And by Hyundai. Learn more at Hyundai.com.
Visit our website, Autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at Autoline.tv.